They hang from the ceiling in Osias. They're framed posters in the classrooms. They're in the front of your hymnal and on those wallet cards we give to every visitor who walks through the doors. And you now know we even have a kids' version. Fewer words, much easier to remember. We call them the seven principles, or the principles and purposes. And along with coffee hour, a commitment to action, and the willingness to argue just about anything, we share these with every other UU congregation in the world. They express who we are. And often, we use them as if they were an alternative to a creed. Now, those wallet cards and bookmarks are really handy when you have to engage in one of those "what do you believe" conversations with folks who've never even heard of Unitarian Universalism. But it's not a creed. We don't have creeds. Being free in faith, we have no tests of membership, no need to divide the world into us and them, believers and not. Which is really quite a good thing, because as a test, the seven principles are a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, all sorts of folks, deeply religious and proudly secular folks, hold those values as well. No, it's not our principles that set us apart. You have to look deeper to find out what that might be. But this morning, I want to do two important things as we consider our first principle. First is, I want to give you a little context and history, and then I have a question. And I haven't written an answer. You can even check my manuscript. It's not here. The answer will be for you to find and share. Okay. Here's the background you need to have this conversation. Those principles and purposes are actually a very practical document. They are the second section of our assembly's bylaws. The first one just says our name, that we are the Unitarian Universalist Association, successor to the American Unitarian Association, and the Universalist Church of America. And back in 1961, when the two denominations merged, that document, which we had to file with the state of Massachusetts, read like this. In accordance with our corporate purposes, we, the members of the Unitarian Universalist Association, dedicated to the principles of a free faith, do hereby unite in seeking to strengthen one another in a free and disciplined search for truth as the foundation of our religious fellowship, to cherish and spread the universal truths taught by the great prophets and teachers of humanity in every age and every tradition, immemorially summarized in the Judeo-Christian heritage as love to God and love to man, to affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality, the dignity of man, and the use of democratic method in human relationships, to implement our vision of one world by striving for one world community founded on ideals of brotherhood, justice, and peace, to serve the needs of member churches and fellowships, to organize new churches and fellowships, and to extend and strengthen liberal religion, to encourage cooperation with men of goodwill in every land. Well, those six are really fewer words than what we've got on our wallet cards today. I mean, you don't have to remember seven. And it may be who we were, but clearly from that reading, it's not who we are. I mean, for one thing, the interdependent web is missing. And our liberal Christian heritage in this 1961 version has yet to be questioned. And the language, kind of sexist, right? supreme worth of every human personality, comma, the dignity of man, brotherhood, men of goodwill. Soon after our merger, the association was drawn into the civil rights movement, and in the 70s, we took up the women's rights movement. Feminism took root in our congregations and changed much. I mean, you'll remember that in America, we were the first, the Universalists, and the second, the Unitarians, to ordain women at all. And that was way back before the Civil War. By the 1970s, we were asking why there weren't more women in our pulpits, more women elected to our boards. And in the debates and conversations of those years, we found, identified the social and institutional obstacles that kept them out. And as a body, we set about changing ourselves. We're now the only faith tradition faced with the question of how to keep our clergy at the current 50-50 balance of men to women. We now have to figure out how to recruit men. No one else has that problem but us. But degenderizing the words wasn't enough. That 10 years of the 70s helped us reimagine ourselves in broader and broader ways. And by 1985, after a multi-year process of conversation and study, our General Assembly changed our bylaws and gave us the principles we now know. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. If you get bored, you can read along with me. Acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning. The right of conscience and the use of democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Quite different from the 60s, isn't it? And it's still not a creed, not even an alternate creed. You'll notice the words I believe or we believe just aren't there. In 1961, we were content to be united in seeking. By 85, we were promising each other to affirm and promote. We UUs come together, form voluntary associations of free congregations to act on these values that we hold. But the principles don't end here. Article 2 goes on. And almost no one has these memorized. The living tradition which we share draws from many sources. Direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. Words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Wisdom from the world's religions, which inspire us in our ethical and spiritual life. Jewish and Christian teachings, which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves. Humanist teachings, which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science, and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. Grateful for the religious pluralism which enriches and ennobles our faith, we're inspired to deepen our understanding and expand our vision. As free congregations, we enter into this covenant, promising to one another our mutual trust and support. The sources provide both a historical and theological context for those seven principles. Here, priorities are stated and some beliefs, at least, are implied. Direct experience. Transcending mystery and wonder. Compare this to the 1961 version, and it's plain that in 24 years, we have begun to create a different relationship to our own roots. Wisdom from the world's religion is third on that list. And then we go on to name 4 specific religious traditions: Judaism and Christianity, humanism, and earth-centered traditions, each equally important to who we are. But even this isn't a creed. For this section of the bylaws ends with a statement about freedom of belief, that nothing herein shall be deemed to infringe upon the individual freedom of belief. One last detail before I leave this quick course in our bylaws. The principles and purposes are not sacred or meant to be eternal. They may be the stones we have to stand up to the Goliaths we meet, but to keep them useful and current, we have required ourselves to review them at least every 15 years. That's this final amendment to our bylaws. That review was done in 2004 and 5, not quite on schedule, but, you know, close enough. And while some suggestions and revisions were brought forward, they didn't garner the votes at General Assembly. But who knows? 2020 is not that far away. Maybe we will decide to change these words in the next 7 years. Now, from the growing nobility of man, which is in your pamphlet, the final harmony of all souls with God, relations between all persons based on a free and mutual consent, to the supreme worth of every human personality and the dignity of man, we have long placed at our core an affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And in the time we have left this morning, about 10 minutes, I'd like us to think together on what this principle really means. Now, the words are pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of exegesis you need to do here. It says what we teach the kids. Every person is important. Each and every human being deserves respect. The principle really is a no-brainer, and most folks on this planet will say, yeah, I'm good with that. We know what sorts of trouble start when the respect is either not communicated or, worse, withheld. Think of your own lives. Most arguments we get into with our family, our friends, be they little tiffs or large weekend fights, start off because one person felt dissed, unheard, ignored, passed over. And whatever the issue was or is, chances are the tension will go on until that respect is restored. And look outside your own life. The injustice we meet in the world comes about every time a lack of respect is codified into custom and law, and whole groups of people are treated as if they were less than others. It's not quite being passed over. It's worse. It's being set aside and held down. So we know what those words mean. My question to you is what meaning does this principle hold in our lives? Why have we moved it to the very first one of all? How do we, as individuals and as a community, go about affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person? Start with an easy answer. Start in the relationships that are easy and comfortable. How do we do it here for each other? How do we do it when we're gathered in this building? How do we do it? What does it mean that we do it?
Looking people in the eye and giving them your full attention.
Treat each person as if they were your friend. Do something, you have to give them attention and to be with them. Mm-hmm. as they run around living their lives.
By trying to walk into each other's shoes and finding common ground with those that are different and that those that think differently from us.
By approaching people feeling, there you are, instead of, here I am.
By doing the best we can to avoid making judgments, which to me is one of the most challenging things I have to do every day.
I think that it's also important to remember to start with yourself, to remember your own inherent worth and dignity. We always talk about, people talk about not judging each other, and then they forget to be compassionate with themselves. It really has to start with yourself.
Keep yourself aware of what's going on around you and avoid conflict, but express your views as they are.
To pause and think about your response when dealing with difficult or unfriendly people.
I think to take the time to appreciate the meaning of the statement, namaste. And when I can do that, it's usually well received. The divine in me bows to the divine in you, or appreciates it's the ability to see the divine in each other. That's how I interpret it.
I think there are like two things. One is to separate what somebody says, to depersonalize, to listen to what is said, not in the framework of how I see it or even who that person is, to clear your mind to actually hear it. I mean, I have an example of an email that I got at one point in my life where my immediate reaction was, oh, that person's attacking me or that person's doing whatever. And then I stepped back and I said, no, wait a second. You know, let's reread it. And when I read it without my filter, I could hear what they were trying to communicate. They were actually trying to be helpful. They were actually making a suggestion. But because of where I was coming from, I read it differently. So it's taking the time to sort of hear what is said and understand that we may filter what it is and then really hear what somebody's trying to offer.
For me, this first principle is it orients the mind philosophically to our standard by which we have moral judgment and ethics, and it's individual and it's very human. So it's human values and it's individual rights.
We're all looking for the truth. But you don't have to be right, but you do have to be kind.
I think it's terribly important what we tell our kids, because so often children are defined by their third or their tenth or their ranking is so-and-so. Being sure to define our children as we would like to be defined ourselves.
We affirm the inherent worth and dignity of others when we forgive them.
To be aware of our own prejudice and inner angers so that we can filter them, change them in interaction with other people and with ourselves.
We have to trust each other that we're going to receive this warm, non-judgmental kindness that we're trying to extend.
Okay, I'm going to make it a little more complicated and then frustrate you because we've got 4 minutes left, and I'm going to stop the conversation then. but maybe this is something you can take out into coffee hour and into your week. If all those things are true, the need for trust, that it's forgiveness, that it's compassion and understanding and discernment of our own judgments, what happens when it's really hard to do? What happens when we're faced with a person who really has done awful things? The standard question we got in divinity school was, and it came on exams year after year, did Hitler have dignity and worth? And how would you show it?
The sixth graders asked me this when I was teaching their class, and what I told them, which was hard because they put you on the spot like that. I'm telling you, they're like, well, what about Hitler? At one point, Hitler was an adorable little toddler crawling into his mother's arms. And you have to understand that people are people and that they're able to be evil and they're able to be good and they have to make those right choices.
I was thinking about this just last night because I had been telling you this story about the young woman who had been sentenced for life for killing the man who had been torturing her. And how upset I was about that. And then I wondered about extending the concept of inherent worth and dignity to that man because I was so angry about this. And I thought, well, first my question was, at what point does somebody's inherent worth and dignity become more important than somebody else's? That was my first step in that. And then the second was, when I think about how we deal with it, I thought immediately of our democratic process. Because if the system had worked the way it was supposed to, and that was the problem, it didn't, but if it had worked the way it was supposed to, that man would have been put through a democratic process that would have fairly assessed what he had done and taken care of the problem. So I think yes, it's farther down the list, the democratic process, but I think that's one of the things that we rely on to point to the inherent worth and dignity of a person.
It's the inherent worth and dignity of everyone. There is no asterisk there. That's everyone. That includes Hitler, terrorists, criminals, killers, everyone. That doesn't mean that we can't have justice, but it means justice, not revenge. It means that we address people with equity and compassion and not out of fear and anger. So when you really take that principle to heart, it should affect everything. Your stance on death penalty, your stance on immigration, your stance on how we address the criminal justice system. Is it put them away or is it rehabilitation? Because there is inherent worth and dignity in everyone. Doesn't excuse their actions, but they as individuals have worth.
Usually the question that comes up in the religious setting is, if God is all good, then how can evil exist? But in a more humanistic thought process, we have a similar problem, is if we assume that people are basically good, then how can evil exist? It's the same thing. It's an anthropodicy instead of the theodicy. And my thinking on this is that we do have to actually confront the question, why does it sometimes go wrong? Why does evil exist in people? And if it's some kind of a psychological problem, if it's something similar to bad programming, being raised to hate others, being raised with a dogmatic thought process that does not accept that other people may think differently or live differently. If these are contributing factors and they're things that we have to face and see, how can we deal with this going into the future in an effective way? So that we can actually face the problem. We can't just deny that it exists because it does exist.
Okay. This was a biggie for me for a long, long time. Basically, through practicing Zen Buddhism, I learned this at a very wise and beautiful woman from this fellowship told me this once, and she's here, but I won't embarrass her. And this was what works for me, and that is that people are not evil. They are capable of doing evil acts. And that can be brought on by all sorts of situations, but the inherent worth and dignity of the person still stands.
There is no end to this sermon, just my hope that the conversation will go on and we can help each other know what we stand for and who we are and how we live it in the world.